Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spratnak. Today, Terry Tempest Williams will be joining us. She's not only a widely acclaimed author, but also a conservationist and an activist, particularly with regard to issues affecting the flora and fauna, including humans, of the Great Basin area of the West. In her new book, entitled When Women Were Birds, she relates a few experiences she's had as an activist, including this one. After the 1994 Republican sweep in the midterm elections, the Utah congressional delegation, led by Representative Jim Hansen and Senator Orrin Hatch, announced they were going to draft a Utah wilderness bill once and for all. They were tired of the decades-old contention over Utah's wildlands. Hansen and Hatch believed, along with the Gingrich Revolution, so-called, that they had the political power to get what they wanted then, which was as little wilderness as possible. The governor, Michael Levitt, reminded them that by law they had to conduct public hearings. So in 1995, January through May, local hearings were held throughout the state. More than 70% of the people in Utah wanted more wilderness, not less. Advocating for the citizens' proposal, which at the time protected 5.7 million acres of wilderness. Utahns were told that their voice would not only be heard, but respected. If you're an activist, I think you know what's coming if you've ever testified before these hearings. I have. Formal congressional subcommittee hearings were then held in Cedar City, Utah, and there were three panels, the political panel, the extractive industry panel, and the conservation panel. I had been asked by the conservation community to speak. We would testify last. Congressman Jim Hansen and his colleagues sat on a riser above us, designed to intimidate. As I stood to speak, Hansen began shuffling through his papers, yawning, coughing, anything to show his boredom and displeasure. I was halfway through my testimony when it became clear that the congressman wasn't even listening. I stopped mid-sentence. Quote, Congressman Hansen, I have been a resident of Utah all my life. Is there anything I can say to you that might in some way alter your perspective on wilderness? Unquote. He looked over the top of his glasses, perched at the end of his nose, slowly leaned on his elbows, and said simply, quote, I'm sorry, Ms. Williams, there is something about your voice I cannot hear, unquote. And then it was over. Now, two things arose in my mind when I read that passage initially. The first was the fact that when the German Green Party first got elected to seats in their national parliament, the Bundestag, in 1983, the female parliamentarians got a reception almost exactly like the one that greeted Terry Tempest Williams. They soon realized microphones in parliament were tuned to male voices, causing the new female parliamentarians to sound odd and off-putting. But then, women's speech has long been found, quote, odd and off-putting to men throughout history in Western culture. And that was a subject of the second association I had with that passage I just read to you. When I was in Germany in the summer of 1983 interviewing 62 German Green parliamentarians and leaders for the book Green Politics over here the next year, one of the people I interviewed was Professor Erika Hickel. She was about in her mid-50s, and she had taught for many, many years in a mostly male university. She taught the history of pharmacology at the Braunschweig Technical University. And during that time of working in this male-oriented institution, she had arrived at a guideline for herself, that she would never serve on committees or be in working groups that didn't have at least one-third women. So when she was nominated by her area to represent them in parliament, she stayed up watching the returns that night. There's kind of a complicated system where she was watching what they call the list. She saw she came in at the top of the list in her area, and she was definitely going to be a member of parliament. But she stayed up late into the night watching all the other areas and calculating the number of green men and women who were going to be in what's called the fraction that goes into parliament. And if the green fraction were not going to be at least one-third women, Erica Hickel was not going to go. She was going to forego that honor rather than serve in a group that, from her experience, would not be able to hear the women. So I think what she's getting at, I know what she was getting at with that rule of one-third, is that women often have a different perception and perspective of what's going on than do men. For instance, I cited in the book Relational Reality, the experiments which have been repeated cross-culturally for decades now, started in the early 1950s, that find that most women, far more than men, tend to perceive the gestalt of a form or a situation. That is, we perceive the dynamically interrelated totality of what's going on in a situation, instead of perceiving mainly the foreground figures. But that's only one aspect of the difference between the ways in which males and females experience life. As my favorite French philosopher, Luce Irigaray, observes, we could have a vibrant culture of intersubjectivity drawing from an ongoing conversation between male subjectivity and female subjectivity if only both halves were present in the societal discussion. Unfortunately, we have instead only a monoculture consisting of language, systems of knowledge, and institutions that have evolved to fit closely with the preferences of the male psyche. So that is to say, both sexes are socialized in language and ways of thinking that derive from male subjectivity. Therefore, women live without our own language to express our authentic perceptions and perspectives about life. I put this issue on the discussion table today because it gives you some context, not only for Terry Tempest Williams' new book, but also for another short little story I'll share with you now. And this is when I met Terry Tempest Williams. We were both presenters at a conference near Washington, D.C. in November of 1995. And I'm not quite sure how we connected, but she suggested we have breakfast, and I thought, wow, this is really great. I get to, in one day, I'm going to have a conversation with the great Terry Tempest Williams, and then I get to go off to the mid-morning presentation and hear the great Christiane Northrup present on her book, Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, which I highly recommend. But that is not exactly what happened. Instead, we sat down together, ordered breakfast, and just fell into this deep conversation that went on at least 2.5 hours. We talked way through the mid-morning presentations we were both planning to go to. It was a great connection, and one of the main things we were talking about was this gap between women's cognitive universe and the words that are available to us in our Indo-European languages to express them. So I want to mention quickly two books that she told me about that day. One is The Ecology of Imagination in Childhood by Edith Cobb. I highly recommend The Ecology of Imagination in Childhood by Edith Cobb. The other book she told me about that morning is by a French feminist, Claudine Hermann, a book published in France in 1976 and subsequently translated with the, I think, unfortunate title of The Tongue Snatchers. That's because the word in French for tongue is also the word for language, which would have been the better way to go. In any event, Claudine Hermann makes the point that women in Western cultures must learn from an early age to be an actress, speaking in language and culture that fits closely with the preferences of the male psyche. She addresses this tragic gap between women's inner lives and the constrained options for expressing those inner perceptions via a language of male subjectivity in a culture that's, yeah, male-centric. So all these fascinating subjects figure largely, I was delighted to discover, in Terry Tempest Williams' new book, When Women Were Birds, as you'll soon see. So let's move into that conversation. My guest today is Carrie Tempest Williams. Her work ranges from issues of ecology and wilderness preservation, especially in the Great Basin, to women's health, to exploring our relationship to culture and nature. I would add that she brings a deep woman's sensibility to her artful musings and observations about all those subjects. Carrie Tempest Williams has testified before Congress on women's health. She has committed acts of civil disobedience during the years 1987 to 1992 in protest against nuclear testing in the Nevada desert, and again in March 2003 in Washington, D.C. with Code Pink against the Iraq War. She's been a guest at the White House, has camped in the remote regions of the Utah and Alaska wildernesses, and has worked as, quote, a barefoot artist, unquote, in Rwanda. She made quite a splash with her first book, Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place, and with several other books since then. I have them all stacked up here from my bookshelf. These include An Unspoken Hunger, Stories from the Field, Desert Quartet, Leap, Red, : Patience and Passion in the Desert, The Open Space of Democracy, Finding Beauty in a Broken World, and the recently published When Women Were Birds. Now, many of you probably watched the BBC series. It was made, I don't know, maybe 15 or more years ago. It was of the P.G. Wodehouse stories about Bertie Wooster and his valet Jeeves. And in one episode, Bertie mentions an author who was popular then in the 1920s and 30s, to which Jeeves gives a slight nod and replies in agreement, "He always gives satisfaction." And that's exactly the response that arises in my mind whenever I see the name Carrie Tempest Williams over an article or an essay or on the cover of a new book. Ah, this will give satisfaction. And it always does. Carrie Tempest Williams, welcome to All Together Now.
Charlene, it's so wonderful to hear your voice, and I'm just going to imagine that you and I are sitting across from each other with a cup of tea. Thank you.
Uh-huh, great. Well, I would like to begin by asking you to read the opening passage in your new book, When Women Were Birds.
Yes. I am 54 years old, the age my mother was when she died. This is what I remember. We were lying on her bed with a mohair blanket covering us. I was rubbing her back, feeling each vertebra with my fingers as a rung on a ladder. It was January, and the ruthless clamp of cold bore down on us outside, yet inside, mother's tenderness and clarity of mind carried its own warmth. She was dying in the same way she was living, consciously. "I am leaving you all my journals," she said, facing the shuttered window as I continued rubbing her back. "But you must promise me that you will not look at them until after I am gone." I gave her my word, and then she told me where they were. I didn't know my mother kept journals. A week later, she died. A month later, I found myself alone in the family home. I kept expecting mother to appear. Her absence became her presence. It was the right time to read her journals. They were exactly where she said they would be, three shelves of beautiful cloth-bound books, some floral, some paisley, others in solid colors. The spines of each were perfectly aligned against the lip of the shelves. I opened the first journal. It was empty. I opened the second journal. It, too, was empty. I opened the third. It was empty, as was the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, shelf after shelf after shelf. All my mother's journals were blank.
Mm. And then that memorable passage is followed in the book by several blank pages, which is very unusual in book design. And then you open the present-day story, explaining that you're now, as you say, at the time of your writing, 54 years old, the age when your mother died, and you're writing this exploration of your own in the pages of the blank journals she left you.
I especially was struck by this paragraph. There's so many ways you distill so much into a few words, and this is one of those spots. My mother's transgression was hunger. She passed her hunger onto me without ever speaking a word. Solitude is a memory of water. I live in the desert, and every day I'm thirsty. When I opened my mother's journals and read emptiness, it translated to longing. That same hunger and thirst mother translated to me. I will rewrite this story, create my own story on the pages of my mother's journals. So, you allude in your book to the contours of Mormon family life, which are very important to your mother's story. For instance, there's one spot where you just briefly tell us that when your father was away on business, your childhood home had a more relaxed atmosphere, as if on vacation from his intensity. And you tell the reader that Mormon women are expected to do two things, have a journal and keep children. Would you tell us a bit more about this context for your mother and her experience? Because it's clear she was, you know, wanting to be her own person and telling you that in certain ways in this beautiful letter she wrote. And yet the system was a very powerful one around her.
You know, Mormonism is filled with paradoxes. First and foremost, Mormonism is about community, and it's deeply held. You're right. I did say, you know, Mormon women are expected to do two things, keep a journal and have children. My mother kept journals, and she had four children. My mother left me her journals, and all her journals were blank. That right there is a paradox. You know, I think about, you call it a system. It really is a culture, and I think we're seeing this with Mitt Romney. You know, I recognized this when I listened to Ann Romney speak the other evening at the Republican convention.
Mm-hmm.
There's much that is very positive and powerful about the Mormon Church. And there's much that I have found in my life oppressive. And I can be honest and open with you, Charlene, as I always am, and with the listeners. You know, I am no longer an Orthodox practicing Mormon. But by the same token, I've not been excommunicated. Mm-hmm. And I still have a voice within this culture, within this religion. When Women Were Birds, this exploration of voice, 54 variations on voice, is rooted within that tradition, because I think in so many ways the Mormon Church has given me my voice. What do I mean by that? Out of resistance, out of an insistence that I speak. My mother was a very private woman. She was not a silent one. And, you know, when I received the shock of her empty journals, it was like a second death. And mm-hmm. I talk about how my mother's journals became paper tombstones. You know, at first I thought, what was she saying? Because it was such a conscious act. Three shelves, empty journals, some of her last words to me as she was dying of cancer were, "I'm leaving you all my journals, but you have to promise me you'll look at them until I'm gone." I thought, was she saying, please write in them, fill them, in ways I can't, couldn't? Or on the other hand, was she saying, be present? Don't spend all of your time looking backwards and forwards, but live now, which my mother did, because at 38 years old, she was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of breast cancer, and she had four children to raise. This gets back to your question. My mother was a practicing Mormon. She was very active in her community, in her church. I have come to see her empty journals on one hand as an act of defiance. I have come to see my mother's journals as an act of aggression. I have come to see my mother's journals as an act of modesty. more than anything, I've come to see my mother's journals as an interrogation. She was a great woman of questions, and she left her questions with me. You know, and Charlene, I have to tell you, you've had an enormous impact on me with your books through the years, Resurgence of the Real, the spiritual sensibility of green politics. You know, at the end of the book, I talk about finding this talk that my mother gave in support of ERA, of the Equal Rights Amendment, in the Mormon Church, which was vehemently opposed and actually organized women against it. It was a very, what should I say, heated time. And it took my mother, I believe it took tremendous courage for her to give that talk. You know, so again, these paradoxes, because on the other hand, I'll never forget the conversation she had with my grandmother when I was present. I was in high school, and my grandmother was very critical of the Mormon Church. And actually, I remember vividly, she said, "Diane, the Mormon Church is demonic. They care nothing for the rights of women." And my mother said, "I'm completely comfortable with my role and rights and power as a woman." And then she turned to my grandmother and said, "I don't ever want you to speak negatively about the Mormon Church in front of my children."
Mm-hmm.
And I remember mother left. I stayed. My grandmother took her clippers out into the garden and cut roses to put in his face, and she looked at me and she said, "Huh, Diane's about to leave the church." So, you know, it's complicated. It's varied. It's dimensional, as are our voices, as was my mother's voice, even her empty journals.
Right. It's complicated, but it's a far cry from, I don't know if you saw yesterday on Huffington Post, there was a long article about Mitt Romney's background in the Mormon Church, and it talks about the time he was a bishop in Belmont, Massachusetts, and these women came to him saying, "You have to do something about verbal abuse going on in these families," or even just, what can I say, excessive dominance. You know, these women said, "My husband won't let me move a piece of furniture without his permission. My husband won't let me visit a friend unless I have his permission." And I thought, oh, good grief. But that's a very far cry from the way your mother and her mother held on to their center, as she advised you, within that community.
It's interesting, Mitt Romney is my cousin.
I was just going to get to that. Your mother's maiden name was Romney, so big night for cousin tonight.
Well, my grandmother, Letty Romney Dixon, was born in Colonial Dublon with George Romney, Mitt's father.
Uh-huh.
And that makes Mitt and I second cousins once removed. He may wish I was more removed. But, you know, I have to tell you, my great-grandmother, Valette Romney, you know, my grandmother, Letty Romney, these are strong women. And I'm sure, you know, that as in every household, in various homes around the country, you know, women have to fight for their solidarity and their voice and their rights. It's not just Mormon women. Having said that, I was very aware growing up that my voice, I was to be seen, not heard in my generation. And yet I'm looking at my nieces, who are very powerful Mormon women, and they have no trouble speaking up and out, and I'm really proud of them. So on one hand, I think the Mormon church is changing because the women in the church are changing, and the world has gotten much smaller and larger at once.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I'll go back to that notion of complexity. I can only speak out of my own experience, and my experience as a young woman was that I had to fight for my voice, and that I was not going to be silent, that as I came of age and read books by Maria Louise von Franz, who was a Jungian analyst and wrote creation myths, I'll never forget thinking, huh, so Adam and Eve is another creation myth, just like changing woman in the Navajo cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my grandmother was hardly Orthodox Mormon. I really thought Joseph Campbell and Krishnamurti and Carl Jung and Esther Harding, you know, were all Mormons on some level. And I have to say, that's why your work, you know, the work of so many women have mattered to me, from Maxine Hong Kingston to Susan Griffin to, I could go on and on, you know, Louise Erdrich, powerful women's voices, Eve Ensler, saying, we have to speak, even at our own peril.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, all that opened up after the beginning of the feminist movement, and Claudine Ehrman in the Tongue Snatchers, or I would say Language Snatchers maybe, she very succinctly lays out these two options at that time. You know, if a woman... here, let me just take a look here. If a woman remains herself and continues to think in terms of harmony and not struggle, of gift and not exchange, she will get herself piteously crushed. If she adopts the current virile values, barrenness, control, power, imperialism, she will succeed at the price of her own destruction, and she will not fail to provoke irony. So... yes,
and
middle
I love
path
that idea.
Has been forged. Sorry?
Well, I love that idea, again, from Claudine Herman, where she talks about that the word voler, to speak, you know, voice, also is the same word as to steal or to flee. And traditionally, that has been our choice as women. We steal the dominant language and take it on as our own, or we flee. And I love how she says there's a third alternative, which is to encompass in body, to speak the mother tongue.
Well, that's the thing, because I think, you know, when the French feminists would talk about disrupting or stealing or something, it's not the Indo-European languages we'd want to steal from. They're very nominalized. They're not designed to talk about process and subtle dynamic interrelationship, which is the way the female mind is perceiving reality. So
right.
I've long thought that the unfinished work of the women's movement is to develop this authentic language. And I know I can hardly say that to myself in 2012, because now there's so much unfinished work, as so much of what we thought we'd accomplish is being unraveled. So there's a lot of competition for what's the most important unfinished work.
It's interesting, you know, and I think about Helena Cixous when she says, we've got to learn to speak the language women speak when there's no one there to correct us.
Uh-huh.
And she's been a driving force for me as a writer, thinking, you know, what does it look like, feel like, to write out of the body, to defy logic as we've been taught,
mm-hmm.
but to be able not only to privilege, but to speak with our authentic vocabulary and language of how we see the world. And, you know, I think my mother was a powerful example of that. I love that in a culture that says you must write, and I have to tell you, I have done that religiously, literally. I have hundreds of journals, dare I say thousands. My mother said, no, I'm going to leave my daughter her journals, and all my journals are blank. And I feel as though if that's not an act of defiance, I don't know what is. My mother literally gave me a Buddhist koan to turn and turn and turn, and I will never know what her real intention was.
Well, that's what I want to say. Where you end up, you take readers through your engagement and rumination on all these various possible meanings of these blank journals. And I won't be a spoiler here and tell listeners where you end up with it on the last page, although I'll say I thought it was exactly right. But I'd like you to share some of those poetic possibilities. Oh, it's to absorb my words. It's this, it's that. When we come back from the break, we do have to pause here for a minute. and I just want to remind you, this is All Together Now. I'm Charlene Spretnak, speaking with my guest, Harry Tempest Williams.
Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Terry Tempest Williams, about her new book, When Women Were Birds. I'd like to explain, before we get back to our conversation, too, to the readers, there's something else that's unusual about this book design, not only the beautiful white birds embossed on the white cover, but in the right margin is a bird. It's a drawing, an ink drawing of a bird, and if you flip the pages quickly, you see the bird flying, and it's very small, and toward the middle, it's getting closer and closer to you. It gets large in the middle, and then it gets smaller as you flip toward the end of the book and finally flies away. So this is a charming addition. And also, I do want to note that this connection of women with birds, birds are so important to Terry Tempest Williams because her mother's mother introduced her to a love of birds and bird watching from an early age, and I think that really put her on this course of being a naturalist and a conservationist. But in the Neolithic cultures of Southeastern Europe were many statues of the bird goddess, statues that were half bird, half woman. So this is a very, very ancient connection, and I'll just put that on the table. Okay, let's jump back in here. Terry, could you tell us about some of the possibilities of meaning you entertained during the book for what these blank journals could mean from your mother and what they could mean now to you?
Now, everything, as we were talking, from a Japanese koan to paper cranes, and perhaps I could just read this section.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's journals are a projection screen. My mother's journals are a blinding light. My mother's journals are a glaring truth. My mother's journals are bleached. My mother's journals are sanitized. My mother's journals are clean. My mother's journals are clean sheets. My mother's journals are white flags of surrender. My mother's journals see ghosts. My mother's journals hear voices. My mother's journals smell desire. My mother's journals touch eternity. My mother's journals are a charity. My mother's journals are a cruelty. My mother's journals are a paper cut. My mother's journals are salt. And I go on with this litany of all the different possibilities that my mother's journals could be. And in the end, I say, my mother's journals tell me nothing. My mother's journals tell me everything. My mother left me all her journals, and all her journals were blank. So it's this ongoing discovery, recovery, questioning of what my mother's intentions really were.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's one little anecdote you tell. It's probably just about halfway through, but it really brings together everything you've been saying here. And that's the lunch meeting you had with your father-in-law when you'd returned from the UN International Conference on Women in, was it
1985.
And mm-hmm. In Kenya, you had met through the conference and become friends with Wangari Maathai and became very interested in the Greenbelt movement that she founded there. So when you came back, you started a fundraising project among the Mormon women in Utah to raise money to send to the Greenbelt movement. And then you decided, it would be possible to really kick it up to a higher level in the church and, you know, maybe do global fundraising for this with the Mormon churches all over the world. So you invited your father-in-law, says a person you do like and respect, to lunch, and you presented this to him, and he said, I think that's a very good idea, and I could speak to so-and-so and get you an interview, an appointment with this even higher-up person who could make this happen. And then
I was just going to say, you've hit, I think you've gone right to the heart of the book. And
but when he says, I could do this for you if you would do one thing for me, and he says, would you speak
to your husband, my son, and convince him to come back into the church. So you two, as you say, you made a decision to stay in the Mormon church in a way that allowed you to be full people and make these contributions to the West that you've made. But when he says that to you, I could do this if you would just be the one who brings him back into the church, the thought that arises silently in your mind is, if I did that, I'd have to be, you know, within the confines, the more strict confines of a Mormon wife, and I would never have a voice. And
it was
so
more
clear
than
that. This doesn't cross his mind. In his mind, why would there be any problem for a woman, you know, just coming back and coloring between the lines? It's the distance between the worlds, and it's you, this next generation, who has to find another way to be Mormon. So I thought that passage was amazing.
Well, I think it even goes deeper than that. You know, this was something, and as I said, I think you've found the core of the book for me, my own story and my own voice. You know, when I went to the UN Decade for Women in Nairobi in 1985, it changed my life completely. And it wasn't the UN forum that changed my life. It wasn't the structure, because that had its own power structure. It was one woman, and that one woman was Wangari Maathai, and she was speaking outside of the forum. And I left. I left the Utah women that I had gone with, and I followed her into the villages in Kenya. And I saw literally rural women gathering the seeds of trees in the folds of their skirt and planting them, that this was their sovereignty, that this was their independence, and this was their relationship to earth, to family, to community. And what I saw is that through Wangari Maathai, that the environmental crisis is the woman's crisis, that environmental issues are economic issues, are issues of social justice. And it was in that moment that I saw that the world is whole. And I came back, and I wanted to be part of that vision. I realized in Utah we had our own issues of environmental degradation and deforestation. It became my own education, and I wanted to educate and work with my own people, my own women who were Mormon, and through the Relief Society, I must have given 100 talks on the Greenbelt Movement, talking about Wangari, talking about these women, talking about gathering firewood 8 to 10 hours a day so that they could cook for their children, and what this tree planting project could mean. You're right. I wanted to see if we could amp this campaign up. And my, you know, no one organizes like the Mormons, and my father-in-law, whom I love, has a position within the church of power. At one point, he was in charge of all the Mormon missions around the world, the Mormon missionaries. And I went to him, and I said, Rex, this is what I'm doing. I'm wondering if you could help me. Could you open those doors to the brethren, to the apostles, which would be like cardinals in the Catholic Church? And he said, yes, I can, and I will be happy to do that for you. But you must do one thing for me. You have to promise me that you will get Brooke to go back into church, and you must promise me that you will never tell him that we had that conversation. And for me, that was a turning point, because I realized I couldn't have it both ways. He forced the issue of integrity, mine. I couldn't be halfway in the church and yet asking them to support my cause. And I certainly couldn't. I couldn't imagine the kind of marriage, first of all, where you would make that kind of Faustian bargain. And second of all, what I knew is that if I had said yes on behalf of Wangari Maathai and the Kenyan woman, if this was what I had said yes to, it would be completely minimizing everything I would be doing. That when one woman is oppressed, all women are oppressed. And I said, I cannot do that. We ended up raising $10,000, not a lot of money, but it was a lot of money from individual women. And, you know, I also have to say that as a writer, that was a really, really difficult piece to write and to put in this book, because it put my relationship to my father-in-law at risk. And I wrote him a long letter I did not ask for his permission to put this in the book. I explained what was behind it as an act of gratitude. He was not happy about it. He wrote me a very honest letter, and he came to one of my readings in Salt Lake, which I really appreciate. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of dialogue that I think we are desperate to have. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to say, I agree to disagree, I love you, but I cannot do this. And for him to say, that's not how I remember it. And what he remembered is that we would both go back to church, that he was calling for our engagement. So, you know, how do we communicate with our own family when we are in very different places of perception? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I look at how we're viewing the Republican convention. I view how my family will be viewing the Democratic convention. I view myself today. We just got news an hour ago that the Obama administration has yet said yes to Shell Oil without a permit from the EPA and without giving a sound plan if an oil spill should occur. Mm-hmm. That is irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
What are we to do with our voices?
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about the Alaska offshore.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Shell Oil has been given the permit, has been given the go-ahead without the permit.
Right, I
get so upset I can't even talk about it. But, I mean, this is where our voice comes in, and it begins with conversation.
Right.
And I think we must always, as Christopher Hitchens talks about, looks to the language, and to realize that the essence of an independent mind and an independent voice is not in what we think, but in how we think and how we go about creating a context where we can create a language that opens hearts rather than closes them.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you moved into the political work, because I wanted to also make sure listeners understand your deep involvement with all of that. And you have a book on this, The Open Space of Democracy, came out a few years ago, published by Orion Magazine. And then also last year you had a very interesting dialogue in Orion Magazine with Tim DeChristopher, who was known as Bitter 70 in that public lands auction, where he pretended to be a private buyer, that the developers, corporate drillers, oil companies were buying up this auction public land, and he wanted to save that part. People can look for that in the archives of Orion. We're not going to have time to get into it, but I would like to close with one of your first acts of activism, your involvement with the Downwinders. And again, I don't want the listeners to miss a bit more of your art. So could we end here with your reading the opening passage from the epilogue in your book, Refuge?
Yes, and Charlene, I just want to thank you so much for this conversation and for your voice and this program that allows us to really speak of these things that matter so much to us in a free society, literally in the open space of democracy.
Thank you.
I belong to a clan of one-breasted women. My mother, my grandmothers, and six aunts have all had mastectomies. Seven are dead. The two who survive have just completed rounds of chemotherapy and radiation. I've had my own problems, two biopsies for breast cancer and a small tumor between my ribs diagnosed as a borderline malignancy. This is my family history. Most statistics tell us breast cancer is genetic, hereditary, with rising percentages attached to fatty diets, childlessness, or becoming pregnant after 30. What they don't say is living in Utah may be the greatest hazard of all. We are a Mormon family with roots in Utah since 1847. The word of wisdom in my family aligned us with good foods, no coffee, no tea, tobacco, or alcohol. For the most part, our women were finished having their babies by the time they were 30, and only one faced breast cancer prior to 1960. Traditionally, as a group of people, Mormons have a low rate of cancer. Do you want me to continue, Charlene?
Yeah, I do.
To that
final line about your clan, go ahead.
Okay. Is our family a cultural anomaly? The truth is, we didn't think about it. Those who did Usually the men simply said, bad genes. The women's attitude was stoic. Cancer was part of life. On February 16th, 1971, the eve of my mother's surgery, I accidentally picked up the telephone and overheard her ask my grandmother what she could expect. Diane, it's one of the most spiritual experiences you will ever encounter. I quietly put down the receiver. 2 days later, my father took my brothers and me to the hospital to visit her. She met us in the lobby in a wheelchair. No bandages were visible. I'll never forget her radiance, the way she held herself in a purple velvet robe, and how she gathered us around her. Children, I am fine. I want you to know that. I want you to know I felt the arms of God around me. We believed her. My father cried. Our mother, his wife, was 38 years old. A little over a year after Mother's death, my father and I were having dinner together. He had just returned from St. George, Utah, where the Tempest Company was completing the gas lines that would service southern Utah. He spoke of his love for the country, the sandstone landscape, bare-boned and beautiful. He had just finished hiking the Kolob Trail in Zion National Park. We got caught up in reminiscing, recalling with fondness our walk up Angel's Landing on his 50th birthday and the years our family had vacationed there. Over dessert, I shared a reoccurring dream of mine. I told my father that for years, as long as I could remember, I saw this flash of light in the night in the desert, that this image had so permeated my being that I could not venture south without seeing it again on the horizon, illuminating buttes and mesas. You did see it, he said. Saw what? The bomb, the cloud. We were driving home from Riverside, California. You were sitting on Diane's lap. She was pregnant. In fact, I remember the day, September 7th, 1957. We had just gotten out of the service. We were driving north past Las Vegas. It was an hour or so before dawn when this explosion went off. We not only heard it, but felt it. I thought the oil tanker in front of us had blown up. We pulled over, and suddenly, rising from the desert floor, we saw it. Clearly, this golden-stemmed cloud, the mushroom. The sky seemed to vibrate with an eerie pink glow. Within a few minutes, a light ash was raining on the car.
We have to stop there. I'm sorry. Just cut to the last line.
Yeah, I think it's at that moment I realized that I belonged to the clan of one-breasted women, women drinking contaminated milk from contaminated cows, even children growing up in the 1950s, nursing from members of the clan of one-breasted women.
Mm. Terry Tempest Williams, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Charlene, and thank you for celebrating my mother's empty journals. Each one of us, the blank page.
Right. What an inspiration you've given us. Okay, let's move over to the Arts Corner from the arts reading we've just had. And our poem today is called Who Writes? It's by Maria Grothwall. She's a poet who lives in Montana, and she's featured on the four-disc DVD set of interviews that accompany the DVD entitled The Journey of the Universe, which has been shown on many public television stations in the past year. This is Maria Grothwall's poem entitled, Who Writes? Galaxies write, spiraling poems of elegant beauty, pushing words of stars, planets, and moons across pages of space-time. Stars write, transforming potential into press and weight of presence, creating from hydrogen, helium, and gravity the vowels and consonants of matter. Planets write, stringing sounds of atomic elements into paragraphs, pages, and scrolls of landscape and seashore, vast storms, and thick, solid rock. This planet writes, savanna, tundra, and hardwood forest, call of raven, spiral of snake, drift of leaf, first laugh of child, long stories of fin, feather, fur, skin, and those sung epics of genetic structure and tectonic plate. Who pushes the pen across the page on your lap? Who ignites the muscles of hand and heart when we write? Who the fire in our brains, the ache in our gut, the gasp of pleasure that keeps us up half the night, writing that drives us through forgotten meals, writing that lets the coffee get cold and the phone unanswered, writing, who? Who sleeps dormant in a fog of no thought, pre-whisper even, dust on an old mirror? Who? Who stirs unexpectedly, labors persistently, edits and edits constantly? Who can't get the words out fast enough? Who is never really silent? Who is loved, and loved first, last, and always, by us who write? Who? Who writes? Living planet of innumerable intricacies? Alchemist star making elements, seeding life? Graceful galaxy birthing stars? Omnipresent, fertile universe? Who writes? Today, being human, universe speaks. I choose. Earth writes today as a woman. For our song today, we'll hear the late Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, the renowned mezzo-soprano who died 6 years ago, too young, of breast cancer at the height of her career. There's a fuller introduction of her work, by the way, in the PRN archives of this program. Just click on June 21st for All Together Now and move the cursor to the last segment. The song we'll hear today is one she sometimes sang as an encore, and it's quite poignant as it talks about crossing over, which she soon did. Here's Deep River, sung by Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. River, sung by the late Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. It's on one of her live concerts albums, if you want to find the CD.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week when my guest will be Sandra Steingraber, who's been called the Rachel Carson of our time. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.